COVID-19 has dominated much of our attention this week on And Another Thing. The latest numbers show that Massachusetts alone has seen more than 750,000 cases since March of 2020, and around 9.5 million vaccine doses have now been distributed. From New England Public Media, this is And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Derek Kennedy. Leadership of the major arts venue for Western Massachusetts, sports betting, and the Big E are also some items in the news this week. We'll look at all of those in our roundtable review of the week's news.
Let's welcome our panel today. We have Natalia Munoz. She is the host of Vaya con Munoz on WHNP Talk Radio. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Larry Parnas is the investigations editor at the Berkshire Eagle.
Hi, Maya. Hi, Darren.
And we have the executive editor of Reminder Publishing, Mike Dobbs. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with the surprise of the week. Gunmaker Smith & Wesson, which is a major employee out here, announced it's going to move its headquarters from Springfield after nearly 170 years. They're going to Tennessee. Smith & Wesson CEO Mark Smith says the company is moving because of pending legislation in Massachusetts that would extend the state's assault weapons ban to manufacturers.
These bills would prevent Smith & Wesson from manufacturing firearms that are legal in almost every state in America, and that are safely used by tens of millions of law-abiding citizens every day exercising their constitutional Second Amendment rights.
All of those products account for about 60% of the company's sales. But Springfield State Representative Bud Williams, he co-sponsored this bill, says Smith & Wesson is using the legislation to hide its true reason for leaving.
They wanted to get to Tennessee and to places where guns are gun laws are a little less intrusive.
And Williams says the company will be able to pay workers far less in Tennessee. So now Smith & Wesson is leaving about 1,000 employees here, and Mayor Sarno estimates it's about 550 Springfield jobs that will be going to Tennessee. Mike Dobbs, did you think you would see the day when this Massachusetts company would move its headquarters elsewhere?
I think it's a big shock for everybody. To see something that is iconic as Smith & Wesson move to Tennessee. However, when you take a look at the deal that they have been offered in Tennessee, it is to their business advantage. It may not be to the advantage of Western Massachusetts's economy, but it's advantage to their economy. I really do believe when you take a look at the House bill that is now sitting in the Public Safety Committee, that it probably would never have been passed. I really think they're using this as an excuse to make the move to a place where they're going to save a whole lot of money in their manufacturing efforts.
Larry, what do you think?
You know, I think whenever there's a development that has to do with guns, there's very likely a subtext to it. And we saw the mayor of Springfield and the local state senator kind of working from the script, both speaking about the importance of saving jobs. And then I think in a similar way, the Smith & Wesson chief also on his script to talk about assaults on the Second Amendment. So it kind of becomes a bit of a theater. I think Mike's right that the package that the company's been offered in Tennessee is very attractive, and it'll be part of a movement of other gun makers to Tennessee.
If Tennessee is going to become the state where gun manufacturers end up producing these weapons that hurt us, that's not a great profile for Tennessee. I understand that there need to be gun manufacturers because there's, you know, for the police, for the military. But these guns that are being manufactured at Smith & Wesson here in Springfield, and I know because a friend of mine works there, she's in the shop, in one of the people who puts these things together. These machine guns do not have to be made, and I'm glad they're not going to be made in Massachusetts.
I thought it was surprising that 60% of the revenue comes from assault weapons for Smith & Wesson. And I guess the ability of the company to keep some footprint in Springfield has to do with the revolver making, which is not a target of this proposed law.
Well, the other thing I'd just like to add in terms of this deal, according to the media reports from Tennessee, Blount County, which is outside of Knoxville, has been trying for years to establish itself as a gun industry center. In fact, they had several major multi-million dollar deals about moving companies there that fell apart. The governor of Tennessee says that Tennessee is a Second Amendment sanctuary. So this move is all about economics, and it's about state governmental climate. I really want to emphasize, I doubt that this legislation really had anything to do with this, except give the president and CEO of Smith & Wesson a really handy talking point excuse for this move.
Let's move on now, panel, if we can, to what's happening here in West Springfield, that big giant fair that everyone has either driven by or actually gone to, over at the Big E, where all six New England states are on display. Now, during COVID and the pandemic, it was such a tragedy that it was closed last year due to precautions, but it's back and their numbers are up over what they were in 2019. How many of you have paid a visit?
I was there last Wednesday.
I got on the roller coaster in Six Flags.
I have not been.
It's interesting, though, how people want to go out and just hang out, either with masks on and hopefully with masks on. They just want to be out and see other people.
And while you were there, and to that point, masks are required when you're inside at the fair just to continue the COVID protocols. But some people have kept them off and kept them away. Is that surprising? And will that deter? Do you think that will deter people from going out?
I don't think so, because if other people are not wearing masks, you can always wear a mask and then you're protected. So if it's about, oh, I can't go there, they don't wear a mask, well, then you wear a mask.
I think the fixation on attendance is interesting in and of itself. Like, who's ready to go out? Who's ready to be with people? You know, if I was running the Big E, I would feel very cheered that our brand easily withstood the pandemic and the shutdown last year. They had a record attendance last Sunday, and they may well on their final Sunday this coming weekend. I just think it's, as Natalia was saying, it's evidence that people have sorely missed just some simple pleasures.
Well, I went over last Wednesday. We do a sort of a roundup story on the Big E every year, and I couldn't go over with two reporters, so I was hiking the fairgrounds last Wednesday. And what fascinated me was the fact that there was about 25 to 30% of the Better Living Center unoccupied by vendors. If you go into the State House, there were significant numbers of vendors, traditional vendors, vendors who are there every year, who are not in the State Houses. For instance, I think it's a sign of the apocalypse that you could not buy Vermont maple syrup in the Vermont building. None of the maple people were there. So I talked to one of the Vermont vendors, and he said that a lot of people canceled, and they canceled because of two reasons. They, for political reasons, they didn't want to wear a mask indoors, which they would have to, and they could not find enough help. They could not find the temporary employees to run the business. I heard the same thing from a vendor who I know in the Connecticut building. There seems to be a lot of people going, but they're not necessarily spending a lot of money because, again, there's this. And I think that this speaks to the point that Natalia was talking about. People want to get out. They want to do something. They want to feel, quote unquote, normal. But the economic realities of the pandemic has made a lot of impact on a lot of families. So maybe they just can't go to the Big E and spend the, you know, $200-$400 that you normally spend at the Big E between eating and tchotchkes and riding the rides.
Well, since we are speaking about people getting out of the house and going back to and trying to enjoy their lives and seeking out entertainment, we have a new director taking over the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. This is after 30 years, Joseph Thompson is stepping down. And the museum board has now chosen UCLA Center for the Performing Arts Artistic Director, Christy Edmonds, as the new director. She is currently based in LA. You might think that the move from Los Angeles to North Adams might be a bit of a letdown for her, but she has been telling everyone, including NEPM's own Jill Kaufman, that you'd be wrong. Edmonds says she finds the way to North Adams has brought the museum to life inspiring.
When I talk to people about what Massmoka is in the town of North Adams, there's this immediate story of how it was the craziest idea that they'd ever heard of. And yet somehow it happened, and now it's this beloved place.
So Larry, let's start with you. Tell us about the community in North Adams. Are they ready for a new leader at Mass MoCA?
I think so. Joe Thompson began this place more than 30 years ago, and much of that 3 decades was pretty tough, scrapping to build it out. If you just become aware, if you are a first time visitor at Mass MoCA, it's awe inspiring what they've accomplished. But it was a clawing and scratching effort at the beginning, and I think Edmonds, given her background in the performing arts, I think that's really a tell here in terms of the board's choice of Christy Edmonds, in that the ability of Mass MoCA to host, as it did last weekend with Fresh Grass, these really pretty big entertainment events that become, that go over and above what is happening inside the galleries and artist studio spaces. It has that power to bring people in. And in a funny way, like Big E having a big year because people want to stand side by side next to each other, Fresh Grass in the courtyards and on Joe's Field for the headliners, it was packed. And that's a real drawing card for Mass MoCA. And she brings a record of doing that. It wasn't particularly Thompson's specialty in terms of the entertainment stuff. But back when it was kind of make or break times for Mass MoCA, now 20 years ago, say, the inclusion of entertainment as a feature of what would happen there really got it up and over the hump in terms of funding and state support. So it was really critical. And in a way, I think this touches that thread through the institution's history.
Larry, as you may know, artists, creative types are extra super duper sensitive. And so here we have a new director coming in after, 30 some years of somebody else. Will there be trouble ahead for this new director as she tries to build new programs, new ways to get people into Mass MoCA?
That's time will tell. Thompson's essentially been gone for a year. He stayed on as an advisor. They had an interim director who I thought her greatest accomplishment was to handle the arrival of a unionized workforce at Mass MoCA. And it was really interesting when this came up in this spring. They went from union cards being signed by a majority of employees to a vote in support of the union within 2 months. And the institution itself offered absolutely no opposition to it. Typically, there's a labor management, back and forth on that, and people trying to win votes and support one way or another. The artists, the staff were saying, come on, this is a progressive institution that supports individual creativity and agency and all that. And the Mass MoCA said, yeah, right, we do. So there was no union fight. So I think maybe one of the tests for Edmonds will be, once it comes time to really settle contracts, is she still on that message and supportive? And there were job losses initially when the pandemic hit at Mass MoCA. That has there are no doubt still feelings within the staff who came back about how that was handled. There are some pretty dramatic pay disparities at this institution and most of the high stakes Berkshire cultural institutions. That can become a fault line. We'll see. I think Edmonds comes in with a lot of goodwill and will certainly have some time to get to know her large staff there. And I give her good odds.
Mike, your thoughts? Anything to add?
I just think it's significant that the New York Times made this a story. So that speaks to the position that Mass MoCA has in terms as an institution. I mean, how many times so the New York Times is going to talk about as essentially a museum director coming into an institution? It's very impressive that this person's reputation precedes her in the manner that it does. I think it's also very impressive that the Arts Center for the Eastern part of the United States and the most prominent newspaper from that art center has trained its eye on Western Massachusetts and on Mass MoCA in doing a story talking about her coming to this institution to be its next leader.
We are reviewing the week's news with Reminder Publishing Executive Editor Mike Dobbs, the host of Vaya con Munoz on WHNP, Natalia Munoz, and Berkshire Eagle Investigations Editor Larry Parnas.
This is And Another Thing.
This is And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. Wagering on sports is now possible in every state that borders Massachusetts, except for Vermont. Regulators in Connecticut cleared the way for sports betting. And yesterday we saw Governor Ned Lamont take himself to Foxwoods and place bets at the casinos there. Lori Lozilla and her husband George are members of the Tribal Nation. They put some money down on the New England Patriots.
We came here to support this huge, momentous milestone for us, getting sports betting, getting people in the doors of Foxwoods to explore the amenities is really going to bring great revenue.
In this state, Governor Baker is in favor of sports betting. The House approved betting on sports, but no action yet from the Massachusetts Senate. Is Massachusetts missing out on an opportunity here to make more money?
Absolutely. Let me just say, in making that comment, I do not gamble. And I don't care about professional sports, but what I do care about is the amount of money that goes across our borders to other states that are offering opportunities for people who, A, like professional sports and also like to gamble. You know, I swear to God, I do not understand the legislative process in our beloved Commonwealth. We have examples of sports betting in other states across the nation. All we had to do is to take a look at what they were doing and cherry pick what works for us. But as usual, we have to reinvent the wheel and go our own way and see the rest of the Northeast do something that we're still twiddling our fingers about. The bottom line is that people are going to bet on sports regardless if it's legal in Massachusetts. They're either going to do it illegally or they're going to go across the border to an adjacent state to do it. In any event, we lose out. And frankly, we can't afford to lose out. We can't afford to have this money go elsewhere if it can stay here.
This was the same argument, I'm sure you recall, Mike, that was made when the casino question came up in Massachusetts. And I always thought it was funny then, you know, the highly principled lawmakers on Beacon Hill using one of the oldest teenager tricks, which is everybody else is doing it. So yes, at the time with casino gambling, a lot of money was going out of Massachusetts to Connecticut in particular. And, you know, and since then, there are so many different ways to fritter away your money as a person who likes to wager, including online. It's really not a question, I think, this time around of whether or not that there would be a benefit, really. It's just, the world has already moved to this place where this is legal, and it's just kind of silly not to be part of it.
You know, I'm going to just bring everybody down. I just don't think it's a good idea ever to write into your, you know, checkbook income the desperation of others. So in Massachusetts, you know, going further into the gambling world, we can, and great. And there are plenty of examples of how other states are doing. Yeah, great. But for me, just in terms of how do we plan our economy here in Massachusetts, I do not think it's a good idea to plan it on gambling, because the people who gamble, there are few who are the high stake rollers, but most people who gamble, they lose their money.
Sport, isn't it? Betting is a sport. Some people do it for recreation. Another big recreational event happening this week is Tom Brady versus Bill Belichick. Who would put their Monopoly money on Brady and who would put it on Belichick? One answer,
Mike,
please.
Mike, say something.
It is well known to NEPM listeners that I could care less about the Patriots and other organized sports. But I acknowledge there's things that I care about that no one else cares about. So my point of view is go your own way and enjoy the manufactured drama of multimillionaire athletes and their great challenges. I'm going to see the new Venom movie this weekend, so I really could care less about the Patriots.
Larry, let me get yours.
Mike, you have to know that Tom Hardy, the star of Venom, is a multimillionaire, performer and entertainer. You're aware of that, of course. I think the whole question about Brady and Belichick, who was the one who was really behind the Patriots' extraordinary success? We had the first chapter of that close with Brady's victory with the Bucs last year. So now they're back. This is sort of a classic made-for-TV thing. I think the Bucs will beat the Patriots. And Belichick might want it more than Brady, but he's has to act out his desires through his team, and he hasn't assembled the team he needs to beat Tom Brady and the Bucs.
There's a Greek tragedy here somewhere regarding Belichick and Tom Brady, but like Mike, I don't care too much about it.
All right, well, let's turn once more to the topic that is still hovering over all of us. COVID is still out there. School districts are having to deal with masks, vaccine requirements. This week on And Another Thing, Massachusetts Education Commissioner Jeff Riley told us about his decision to extend the requirements that masks be worn in schools. But as of the 15th of October, that rule won't apply to schools where there's 80% or higher vaccination rate among students and staff. Now, on December 1st, the Amherst Pelham Regional School Committee wants all eligible students vaccinated. Committee member Peter Demling criticized Massachusetts education officials, as well as Governor Baker, for not taking statewide action.
I know they're not health professionals, but it's their job to lead. It's their job to look after the safety of our children and our staff. And they're not doing it. And they're leaving it to local authorities.
What do we think about this edict from the school district?
I think it makes sense. This pandemic is a serious thing. It's very serious. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have died. Lots of people have become very, very sick and will not fully recover. So I think that just because everything looks normal doesn't mean that everything is normal.
Larry, you had a thought.
I don't think too many districts are going to follow Amherst on this. There's a lot of complications because there's really not vaccines that are approved yet for all of the age range of these kids, maybe upper high school. I think it's important to remember that we are in this Delta wave. I mean, it's not as dramatic as last winter, but it's been significant. It could be the final last hurrah of this pandemic, or maybe not. So I think, but with that in the background, I don't think other districts will adopt this policy.
We are out of time. We are going to leave it there. Thank you to each of our panelists today. As we have reviewed the week's news, we were joined by Larry Parnas, investigations editor for the Berkshire Eagle. Mike Dobbs is the executive editor of Reminder Publishing. And Natalia Munoz is the host of Vaya con Munoz on WHNP.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us again on And Another Thing, a daily production of New England Public Media.
Producers for And Another Thing are Denise Vozella and Alexandria Suvaro.
The managing director of And Another Thing is Mark Degon. Chief Content Officer for New England Public Media is Maxie Jackson. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. We hope you'll join us again.